which one can handle without danger, or like a crumb of dynamite which one can use to light one's cigarette without fear of an explosion. Meanwhile, there was in me another force which was striving with all its might to overpower that unwholesome force which still showed me, without alteration, the figure of Gilberte walking in the dusk. To meet and to break the shock of the renewed assaults of memory, I had, toiling effectively on the other side, imagination. The former force did indeed continue to show me that couple walking in the Champs-Élysées, and offered me other disagreeable pictures drawn from the past, as, for instance, Gilberte shrugging her shoulders when her mother asked her to stay and entertain me. But the other force, working upon the canvas of my hopes, outlined a future far more attractively developed than this poor past, which, after all, was so restricted. For 1 minute in which I saw Gilberte's sullen face, how many were there in which I planned to my own satisfaction all the steps that she was to take towards our reconciliation, perhaps even towards our betrothal? It is true that this force which my imagination was concentrating upon the future, it was drawing for all that from the past. I was still in love with her whom, it is true, I believed that I detested. But whenever anyone told me that I was looking well or was nicely dressed, I wished that she could have been there to see me. I was irritated by the desire that many people showed about this time to ask me to their houses and refused all their invitations. There was a scene at home because I did not accompany my father to an official dinner at which the bon ton were to be present with their niece Albertine, a young girl still hardly more than a child. So it is that the different periods of our life overlap one another. We scornfully decline, because of one whom we love, and who will some day be of so little account, to see another, who is of no account today, with whom we shall be in love tomorrow, and whom we might, perhaps, had we consented to see her now, have fallen in love a little earlier, and who would thus have put a term to our present sufferings, bringing others, it is true, in their place. Mine was steadily growing less. I had the surprise of discovering in my own heart one sentiment one day, another the next, generally inspired by some hope or some fear relative to Gilberte. To the Gilberte whom I kept within me. I ought to have reminded myself that the other, the real Gilberte, was perhaps entirely different from mine, knew nothing of the regrets that I ascribed to her, was thinking probably less about me not merely than I was thinking about her, but that I made her be thinking about me when I was closeted alone with my fictitious Gilberte, wondering what really were her feelings with regard to me, and so imagining her attention as constantly directed towards myself. During those periods in which our bitterness of spirit, though steadily diminishing, still persists, a distinction must be drawn between the bitterness which comes to us from our constantly thinking of the person herself and that which is revived by certain memories, some cutting speech, some word in a letter that we have had from her. The various forms which that bitterness can assume we shall examine when we come to deal with another and later love affair. For the present, it must suffice to say that of these two kinds, the former is infinitely the less cruel. That is because our conception of the person, since it dwells always within ourselves, is there adorned with a halo with which we are bound before long to invest her, and bears the marks, if not of the frequent solace of hope, at any rate of the tranquillity of a permanent sorrow. It must also be observed that the image of a person who makes us suffer counts for little, if anything, in those complications which aggravate the unhappiness of love, prolong it, and prevent our recovery, just as in certain maladies the cause is insignificant beyond comparison with the fever which follows it, and the time that must elapse before our convalescence. But if the idea of the person whom we love catches and reflects a ray of light from a mind which is on the whole optimistic, it is not so with those special memories, those cutting words, that inimical letter. I received only one that could be so described from Gilberte. You would say that the person herself dwelt in those fragments, few and scattered as they were, and dwelt there multiplied to a power of which she falls ever so far short in the idea which we are accustomed to form of her as a whole. Because the letter has not, as the image of the beloved creature has, been contemplated by us in the melancholy calm of regret. We have read it, devoured it in the fearful anguish with which we were wrung by an unforeseen misfortune. Sorrows of this sort come to us in another way, from without, and it is along the road of the most cruel suffering that they have penetrated to our heart. The picture of our friend in our mind, which we believe to be old, original, authentic, has in reality been refashioned by her many times over. The cruel memory is not itself contemporary with the restored picture. It is of another age. It is one of the rare witnesses to a monstrous past. But inasmuch as this past continues to exist save in ourselves, who have been pleased to substitute for it a miraculous age of gold, a paradise in which all mankind shall be reconciled, those memories, those letters, carry us back to reality, and cannot but make us feel, by the sudden pang they give us, what a long way we have been borne from that reality, by the baseless hopes engendered daily while we waited for something to happen. Not that the said reality is bound always to remain the same, though that does indeed happen at times. There are in our life any number of women whom we have never wished to see again, and who have quite naturally responded to our in no way calculated silence with a silence as profound. Only in their case, we never loved them. We have never counted the years spent apart from them, and this instance, which would invalidate our whole argument, we are inclined to forget when we are considering the healing effect of isolation, just as people who believe in presentiments forget all the occasions on which their own have not come true. But after a time, absence may prove efficacious. The desire, the appetite for seeing us again, may after all be reborn in the heart which at present condemns us. Only, we must allow time. Now the demands which we ourselves make upon time are no less exorbitant than those of a heart in process of changing. For one thing, time is the very thing that we are least willing to allow, for our own suffering is keen and we are anxious to see it brought to an end. And then, too, the interval of time which the other heart needs to effect its change, our own heart will have spent in changing itself also. So that when the goal which we had set ourselves becomes attainable, it will have ceased to count as a goal, or to seem worth attaining. This idea, however, that it will be attainable, that what, when it no longer spells any good fortune to us, we shall ultimately secure, is not good fortune, this idea embodies a part, but a part only, of the truth. Our good fortune accrues to us when we've grown indifferent to it. But the very fact of our indifference will have made us less exacting, and allow us in retrospect to feel convinced that we should have been in raptures over our good fortune had it come at a time when, very probably, it would have seemed to us miserably inadequate. People are not very hard to satisfy, nor are they very good judges of matters in which they take no interest. The friendly overtures of a person whom we no longer love, overtures which strike us in our indifference to her as excessive, would perhaps have fallen a long way short of satisfying our love. Those tender speeches, that invitation or acceptance, we think only of the pleasure which they would have given us, and not of all those other speeches and meetings by which we should have wished to see them immediately followed, which we should, as likely as not, simply by our avidity for them, have precluded from ever happening. So that we can never be certain that the good fortune which comes to us too late, when we are no longer in love, is altogether the same as that good fortune, the want of which made us at one time so unhappy. There is only one person who could decide that. Our ego of those days. He is no longer with us, and were he to reappear, no doubt that would be quite enough to make our good fortune, whether identical or not, vanish. Pending these posthumous fulfillments of a dream in which I should not, when the time came, be greatly interested, by dint of my having to invent, as in the days when I still hardly knew Gilberte, speeches, letters in which she implored my forgiveness, swore that she had never loved anyone but myself, and besought me to marry her, a series of pleasant images incessantly renewed came by degrees to hold a larger place in my mind than the vision of Gilberte and the young man, which had nothing now to feed upon. At this point I should perhaps have resumed my visits to Madame Swann, but for a dream that came to me, in which one of my friends, who was not, however, one that I could identify, behaved with the utmost treachery towards me, and appeared to believe that I had been treacherous to him. Abruptly awakened by the pain which this dream had given me, and finding that it persisted after I was awake, I turned my thoughts back to the dream, racked my brains to discover who could have been the friend whom I had seen in my sleep, the sound of whose name, a Spanish name, was no longer distinct in my ears. Combining Joseph's part with Pharaoh's, I set to work to interpret my dream. I knew that when one is interpreting a dream, it is often a mistake to pay too much attention to the appearance of the people one saw in it, who may perhaps have been disguised or have exchanged faces, like those mutilated saints on the walls of cathedrals, which ignorant archaeologists have restored, fitting the body of one to the head of another and confusing all their attributes and names. Those that people bear in a dream are apt to mislead us. The person with whom we are in love is to be recognized only by the intensity of the pain that we suffer. From mine I learned that though transformed while I was asleep into a young man, the person whose recent betrayal still hurt me was Gilberte. I remembered then that the last time I had seen her, on the day when her mother had forbidden her to go out to a dancing lesson, she had, whether in sincerity or in make-believe, declined, laughing in a strange manner, to believe in the genuineness of my feeling for her. And by association, this memory brought back to me another. Long before that, it had been Swann who would not believe in my sincerity, nor that I was a suitable friend for Gilberte. In vain had I written to him. Gilberte had brought back my letter and had returned it to me with the same incomprehensible laugh. She had not returned it to me at once. I remembered now the whole of that scene behind the clump of laurels. As soon as one is unhappy, one becomes moral. Gilberte's recent antipathy for me seemed to me a judgment delivered on me by life for my conduct that afternoon. Such judgments one imagines one can escape because one looks out for carriages when one is crossing the street and avoids obvious dangers. But there are others that take effect within us. The accident comes from the side to which one has not been looking, from inside. From the heart. Gilberte's words, "If you like, we might go on wrestling," made me shudder. I imagined her behaving like that at home, perhaps, in the linen room, with the young man whom I had seen escorting her along the Avenue des Champs-Élysées. And so, Just as when, a little time back, I had believed myself to be calmly established in a state of happiness, it had been fatuous in me, now that I had abandoned all thought of happiness, to take for granted that at least I had grown and was going to remain calm. For so long as our heart keeps enshrined with any permanence the image of another person, it is not only our happiness that may at any moment be destroyed. When that happiness has vanished, when we have suffered, and later when we have succeeded in lulling our sufferings to sleep, the thing then that is as elusive, as precarious as ever our happiness was, is our calm. Mine returned to me in the end, for the cloud which, lowering our resistance, tempering our desires, has penetrated in the train of a dream, the enclosure of our mind is bound in course of time to dissolve, permanence and stability being assured to nothing in this world, not even to grief. Besides, those whose suffering is due to love are, as we say of certain invalids, their own physicians. As consolation can come to them only from the person who is the cause of their grief, and as their grief is an emanation from that person, it is there in their grief itself that they must in the end find a remedy, which it will disclose to them at a given moment, for as long as they turn it over in their minds, this grief will continue to show them fresh aspects of the loved, the regretted creature, at one moment so intensely hateful that one has no longer the slightest desire to see her, since before finding enjoyment in her company, one would have first to make her suffer, at another so pleasant that the pleasantness in which one has invested her, one adds to her own stock of good qualities, and finds in it a fresh reason for hope. But even though the anguish that had reawakened in me did at length grow calm, I no longer wished, except just occasionally, to visit Madame Swann. In the first place because, among those who love and have been forsaken, the state of incessant, even if unconfessed, expectancy in which they live undergoes a spontaneous transformation, and while to all appearance unchanged, substitutes for its original elements others that are precisely the opposite. The first were the consequences of, a reaction from, the painful incidents which had upset us. The tension of waiting for what is yet to come is mingled with fear, all the more since we desire at such moments, should no message come to us from her whom we love, to act for ourselves, and are none too confident of the success of a step which, once we have taken it, we may find it impossible to follow up. But presently, without our having noticed any change, this tension, which still endures, is sustained, we discover, no longer by our recollection of the past, but by anticipation of an imaginary future. From that moment it is almost pleasant. Besides, the first state, by continuing for some time, has accustomed us to living in expectation. The suffering that we felt during those last meetings survives in us still, but is already lulled to sleep. We are in no haste to arouse it, especially as we do not see very clearly what to ask for now. The possession of a little more of the woman whom we love would only make more essential to us the part that we did not yet possess, which is bound to remain whatever happens, since our requirements are begotten of our satisfactions, an irreducible quantity. Another final reason came later on to reinforce this and to make me discontinue altogether my visits to Madame Swann. This reason, slow in revealing itself, was not that I had now forgotten Gilberte, but that I must make every effort to forget her as speedily as possible. No doubt, now that the keen edge of my suffering was dulled, my visits to Madame Swann had become once again, for what sorrow remained in me, the sedative and distraction which had been so precious to me at first. But what made the sedative efficacious made the distraction impossible, namely, that with these visits the memory of Gilberte was intimately blended. The distraction would be of no avail to me unless it was employed to combat a sentiment which the presence of Gilberte no longer nourished, thoughts, interests, passions in which Gilberte should have no part. These states of consciousness, to which the person whom we love remains a stranger, then occupy a place which, however small it may be at first, is always so much reconquered from the love that has been in unchallenged possession of our whole soul. We must seek to encourage these thoughts, to make them grow, while the sentiment which is no more now than a memory dwindles, so that the new elements introduced into our mind contest with that sentiment, wrest from it an ever-increasing part of our soul, until at last the victory is complete. I decided that this was the only way in which my love could be killed. And I was still young enough, still courageous enough, to undertake the attempt, to subject myself to that most cruel grief which springs from the certainty that whatever time one may devote to the effort, it will prove successful in the end. The reason I now gave in my letters to Gilberte for refusing to see her was an allusion to some mysterious misunderstanding, wholly fictitious, which was supposed to have arisen between her and myself, and as to which I had hoped at first that Gilberte would insist upon my furnishing her with an explanation. But, as a matter of fact, never, even in the most insignificant relations in life, does a request for enlightenment come from a correspondent who knows that an obscure, untruthful, incriminating sentence has been written on purpose, so that he shall protest against it, and is only too glad to feel when he reads it that he possesses, and to keep in his own hands, the initiative in the coming operations. For all the more reason is this so in our more tender relations, in which love is endowed with so much eloquence, indifference with so little curiosity. Gilberte, having never appeared to doubt nor sought to learn more about this misunderstanding, it became for me a real entity, to which I referred anew in every letter. And there is in these baseless situations, in the affectation of coldness, a sort of fascination which tempts one person to persevere in them. By dint of writing, "Now that our hearts are sundered," so that Gilberte might answer, "But they are not. Do explain what you mean," I had gradually come to believe that they were. By constantly repeating, "Life may have changed for us, it will never destroy the feeling that we had for one another," in the hope of hearing myself one day say, "But there has been no change, the feeling is stronger now than ever it was," I was living with the idea that life had indeed changed, that we should keep only the memory of a feeling which no longer existed, as certain neurotics, from having at first pretended to be ill, end by becoming chronic invalids. Now, whenever I had to write to Gilberte, I brought my mind back to this imagined change, which, being now tacitly admitted by the silence which she preserved with regard to it in her replies, would in future subsist between us. Then Gilberte ceased to make a point of ignoring it. She too adopted my point of view. And, as in the speeches at official banquets, when the foreign sovereign who is being entertained adopts practically the same expressions as have just been used by the sovereign who is entertaining him, whenever I wrote to Gilberte, "Life may have parted us, the memory of the days when we knew one another will endure," she never failed to respond, "Life may have parted us, it cannot make us forget those happy hours which will always be dear to us both." Though we should have found it hard to say why or how life had parted us, or what change had occurred. My sufferings were no longer excessive. And yet, one day when I was telling her in a letter that I had heard of the death of our old barley-sugar woman in the Champs-Élysées, as I wrote the words, "I felt at once that this would distress you, in me it awakened a host of memories," I could not restrain myself from bursting into tears when I saw that I was speaking in the past tense, as though it were of some dead friend now almost forgotten, of this love of which, in spite of myself, I had never ceased to think as of a thing still alive, or one that at least might be born again. Nothing can be more affectionate than this sort of correspondence between friends who do not wish to see one another any more. Gilberte's letters to me had all the delicate refinement of those which I used to write to people who did not matter, and showed me the same apparent marks of affection which it was so pleasant for me to receive from her. But as time went on, every refusal to see her disturbed me less, and as she became less dear to me, my painful memories were no longer strong enough to destroy by their incessant return the growing pleasure which I found in thinking of Florence or of Venice. I regretted at such moments that I had abandoned the idea of diplomacy and had condemned myself to a sedentary existence in order not to be separated from a girl whom I should not see again and had already almost forgotten. We construct our house of life to suit another person, and when at length it is ready to receive her, that person does not come. Presently she is dead to us, and we live on, a prisoner within the walls which were intended only for her. If Venice seemed to my parents to be a long way off and its climate treacherous, it was at least quite easy for me to go without tiring myself and settle down at Baalbek. But to do that, I should have had to leave Paris, to forego those visits, thanks to which, infrequent as they were, I might sometimes hear Madame Swann telling me about her daughter. Besides, I was beginning to find in them various pleasures in which Gilberte had no part. When spring drew round, and with it the cold weather during an icy Lent and the hailstorms of Holy Week, as Madame Swann began to find it cold in the house, I used often to see her entertaining her guests in her furs, her shivering hands and shoulders hidden beneath the gleaming white carpet of an immense rectangular muff and cape, both of ermine, which she had not taken off coming in from her drive, and which suggested the last patches of the snows of winter, more persistent than the rest, which neither the heat of the fire nor the advancing season had succeeded in melting. And the whole truth about these glacial but already flowering weeks was suggested to me in this drawing-room, which I should be entering no more, by other more intoxicating forms of whiteness, that, for example, of the guelder roses clustering at the summits of their tall bare stalks, like the rectilinear trees in pre-Raphaelite paintings, their balls of blossom, divided yet composite, white as annunciating angels, and breathing a fragrance as of lemons. For the mistress of Tansonville knew that April, even an ice-bound April, was not barren of flowers, that winter, spring, summer are not held apart by barriers as hermetic as might be supposed by the town-dweller, who, until the first hot day, imagines the world as containing nothing but houses that stand naked in the rain. That Madame Swann was content with the consignments furnished by her Cambrai gardener, that she did not, by the intervention of her own special florist, fill up the gaps left by an insufficiently powerful magic with subsidies borrowed from a precocious Mediterranean shore, I do not for a moment suggest, nor did it worry me at the time. It was enough to fill me with longing for country scenes that, overhanging the loose snowdrifts of the muff in which Madame Swann kept her hands, the guelder rose snowballs, which served very possibly in the mind of my hostess no other purpose than to compose, on the advice of Bergotte, a symphony in white with her furniture and her garments, reminded me that what the Good Friday musical in Parsifal symbolized was a natural miracle which one could see performed every year, if one had the sense to look for it, and assisted by the acid and heady perfume of the other kinds of blossom, which, although their names were unknown to me, had brought me so often to a standstill to gaze at them on my walks round Cambrai, made Madame Swann's drawing-room as virginal, as candidly in bloom, without the least vestige of greenery, as overladen with genuine scents of flowers, as was the little lane by Tansonville. But it was still more than I could endure that these memories should be recalled to me. There was a risk of their reviving what little remained of my love for Gilberte. Besides, albeit I no longer felt the least distress during these visits to Madame Swann, I extended the intervals between them and endeavoured to see as little of her as possible. At most, since I continued not to go out of Paris, I allowed myself an occasional walk with her. Fine weather had come at last, and the sun was hot. As I knew that before luncheon Madame Swann used to go out every day for an hour, and would stroll for a little in the Avenue du Bois near the Étoile, a spot which at that time, because of the people who used to collect there to gaze at the swells, whom they knew only by name, was known as the Shabby Genteel Club, I persuaded my parents on Sundays, for on weekdays I was busy all morning, to let me postpone my luncheon until long after theirs, until 1:15, and go for a walk before it. During May that year, I never missed a Sunday, for Gilberte had gone to stay with friends in the country. I used to reach the Arc de Triomphe about noon. I kept watch at the entrance to the avenue, never taking my eyes off the corner of the side street along which Madame Swann, who had only a few yards to walk, would come from her house. As by this time many of the people who had been strolling there were going home to luncheon, those who remained were few in number, and for the most part fashionably dressed. Suddenly, on the gravelled path, unhurrying, cool, luxuriant, Madame Swann appeared, displaying around her a toilet which was never twice the same, but which I remember as being typically mauve. Then she hoisted and unfurled at the end of its long stalk, just at the moment when her radiance was most complete, the silken banner of a wide parasol of a shade that matched the showering petals of her gown. A whole troop of people escorted her. Swann himself, 4 or 5 fellows from the club, who had been to call upon her that morning, or whom she had met in the street, and their black or grey agglomeration, obedient to her every gesture, performing the almost mechanical movements of a lifeless setting in which Odette was framed, gave to this woman, in whose eyes alone was there any intensity, the air of looking out in front of her from among all those men, as from a window behind which she had taken her stand, and made her emerge there, frail but fearless, in the nudity of her delicate colours, like the apparition of a creature of a different species, of an unknown race, and of almost martial strength, by virtue of which she seemed by herself a match for all her multiple escort. Smiling, rejoicing in the fine weather, in the sunshine which had not yet become trying, with the air of calm assurance of a creator who has accomplished his task and takes no thought for anything besides, certain that her clothes, even though the vulgar herd should fail to appreciate them, were the smartest anywhere to be seen, she wore them for herself and for her friends, naturally, without exaggerated attention to them, but also without absolute detachment, not preventing the little bows of ribbon upon her bodice and skirt from floating buoyantly upon the air before her, like separate creatures of whose presence there she was not unconscious, but was indulgent enough to let them play if they chose, keeping their own rhythm, provided that they accompanied her where she led the way, and even upon her mauve parasol, which as often as not she had not yet put up when she appeared on the scene, she let fall now and then, as though upon a bunch of Parma violets, a gaze happy and so kindly that, When it was fastened no longer upon her friends, but on some inanimate object, her eyes still seemed to smile. She thus kept open, she made her garments occupy that interval of smartness, of which the men with whom she was on the most familiar terms respected both the existence and its necessity, not without showing a certain deference, as of profane visitors to a shrine, an admission of their own ignorance, an interval over which they recognized that their friend had, as we recognize that a sick man has over the special precautions that he has to take, or a mother over her children's education, a competent jurisdiction. No less than by the court which encircled her and seemed not to observe the passers-by, Madame Swann, by the lateness of her appearance there, at once suggested those rooms in which she had spent so long, so leisurely a morning, and to which she must presently return for luncheon. She seemed to indicate their proximity by the unhurrying ease of her progress, like the turn that one takes up and down one's own garden. Of those rooms one would have said that she was carrying about her still the cool indoor shade. But for that very reason, the sight of her gave me only a stronger sensation of open air and warmth. All the more because, being assured in my own mind that in accordance with the liturgy, with the ritual in which Madame Swann was so profoundly versed, her clothes were connected with the time of year and of day, by a bond both inevitable and unique, I felt that the flowers upon the stiff straw brim of her hat, the baby ribbons upon her dress, had been even more naturally born of the month of May than the flowers in the garden and in woods, and to learn what latest change there was in weather or season, I had not to raise my eyes higher than to her parasol, open and outstretched like another, a nearer sky, round, clement, mobile, blue. For these rites, if they were of sovereign importance, subjugated their glory, and consequently Madame Swann her own, in condescending obedience to the day, the spring, the sun, none of which struck me as being sufficiently flattered that so elegant a woman had been graciously pleased not to ignore their existence, and had chosen on their account a gown of a brighter, of a thinner fabric, suggesting to me by the opening of its collar and sleeves the moist warmness of the throat and wrists that they exposed, in a word, had taken for them all the pains that a great personage takes who, having gaily condescended to pay a visit to common folk in the country, whom everyone, even the most plebeian, knows, yet makes a point of donning, for the occasion, suitable attire. On her arrival, I would greet Madame Swann. She stopped me and say, in English, "Good morning," and smile. We would walk a little way together. And I learned then that these canons according to which she dressed, it was for her own satisfaction that she obeyed them, as though yielding to a superior wisdom of which she herself was high priestess. For if it should happen that feeling too warm she threw open or even took off altogether and gave me to carry the jacket which she had intended to keep buttoned up, I would discover in the blouse beneath it a thousand details of execution which had had every chance of remaining there unperceived, like those parts of an orchestral score to which the composer has devoted infinite labour, albeit they may never reach the ears of the public. Or in the sleeves of the jacket that lay folded across my arm, I would see, I would drink in slowly for my own pleasure or from affection for its wearer, some exquisite detail, a deliciously tinted strip, a lining of mauve satinette which, ordinarily concealed from every eye, was yet just as delicately fashioned as the outer parts, like those Gothic carvings on a cathedral, hidden on the inside of a balustrade 80 feet from the ground, as perfect as are the bas-reliefs over the main porch, and yet never seen by any living man until, happening to pass that way upon his travels, an artist obtains leave to climb up there among them, to stroll in the open air, sweeping the whole town with a comprehensive gaze between the soaring towers. What enhanced this impression, that Madame Swann was walking in the avenue as though along the paths of her own garden, was, for people ignorant of her habit of taking exercise, that she had come there on foot, without any carriage following, she whom once May had begun they were accustomed to see behind the most brilliant turnout, the smartest liveries in Paris, gently and majestically seated, like a goddess, in the balmy air of an immense Victoria on 8 springs. On foot, Madame Swann had the appearance, especially as her pace began to slacken in the heat of the sun, of having yielded to curiosity, of committing an exclusive breach of all the rules of her code, like those crowned heads who, without consulting anyone, accompanied by the slightly scandalized admiration of a suite which dares not venture any criticism, step out of their boxes during a gala performance and visit the lobby of the theatre, mingling for a moment or two with the rest of the audience. So, between Madame Swann and themselves, the crowd felt that there existed those barriers of a certain kind of opulence which seemed to them the most insurmountable that there are. The Faubourg Saint-Germain may have its barriers also, but these are less telling to the eyes and imagination of the shabby genteel. These latter, when in the presence of a real personage, more simple, more easily mistaken for the wife of a small professional or businessman, less remote from the people, will not feel the same sense of their own inequality, almost of their unworthiness, as dismays them when they encounter Madame Swann. Of course, women of that sort are not themselves dazzled as the crowd are by the brilliance of their apparel. They have ceased to pay any attention to it, but only because they have grown used to it, that is to say, have come to look upon it more and more as natural and necessary, to judge their fellow creatures according as they are more or less initiated into these luxurious ways, so that the grandeur which they allow themselves to display or discover in others being wholly material, easily verified, slowly acquired, the lack of it hard to compensate, if such women place a passer-by in the lowest rank of society, it is by the same instinctive process that has made them appear to him as in the highest, that is to say, instinctively at first sight, and without possibility of appeal. Perhaps that special class of society, which included in those days women like Lady Israels, who mixed with the women of the aristocracy, and Madame Swann, who was to get to know them later on, that intermediate class, inferior to the Faubourg Saint-Germain, since it ran after the denizens of that quarter, but superior to everything that was not of the Faubourg Saint-Germain, possessing this peculiarity that, while already detached from the world of the merely rich, it was riches still that it represented, but riches that had been canalized, serving a purpose, swayed by an idea that was artistic, malleable gold, chased with a poetic design, taught to smile. Perhaps that class, in the same form at least and with the same charm, exists no longer. In any event, the women who were its members would not satisfy today what was the primary condition on which they reigned, since, with advancing age, they have lost, almost all of them, their beauty. Whereas it was, just as much as from the pinnacle of her noble fortune, from the glorious zenith of her ripe and still so fragrant summer, that Madame Swann, majestic, smiling, kind, as she advanced along the Avenue du Bois, saw like Hypatia beneath the slow tread of her feet, worlds revolving. Various young men, as they passed, looked at her anxiously, not knowing whether their vague acquaintance with her, especially since having been introduced only once at the most to Swann, they were afraid that he might not remember them, was sufficient excuse for their venturing to take off their hats. And they trembled to think of the consequences, as they made up their minds, asking themselves whether the gesture, so bold, so sacrilegious a tempting of Providence, would not let loose the catastrophic forces of nature, or bring down upon them the vengeance of a jealous God. It provoked only, like the winding of a piece of clockwork, a series of gesticulations from little, responsive, bowing figures, who were none other than Odette's escort, beginning with Swann himself, who raised his tall hat lined in green leather with an exquisite courtesy, which he had acquired in the Faubourg Saint-Germain, but to which was no longer wedded the indifference that he would at one time have shown. Its place was now taken, as though he had been to some extent permeated by Odette's prejudices, at once by irritation at having to acknowledge the salute of a person who was none too well-dressed, and by satisfaction at his wife's knowing so many people. A mixed sensation, to which he gave expression by saying to the smart friends who walked by his side, "What, another? Upon my word, I can't imagine where my wife picks all these fellows up." Meanwhile, having greeted with a slight movement of her head the terrified youth, who had already passed out of sight, though his heart was still beating furiously, Madame Swann turned to me.
"Then it's all over," she put it to me. "You aren't ever coming to see Gilberte again? I'm glad you make an exception of me, and are not going to drop me straight away. I like seeing you. But I used to like also the influence you had over my daughter. I'm sure she's very sorry about it, too. However, I mustn't bully you, or you'll make up your mind at once that you never want to set eyes on me again."
"Odette, Sagan's trying to speak to you," Swann called his wife's attention. And there indeed was the prince, as in some transformation scene at the close of a play, or in a circus, or an old painting, wheeling his horse round so as to face her in a magnificent heroic pose, and doffing his hat with a sweeping theatrical and, so to speak, allegorical flourish, in which he displayed all the chivalrous courtesy of a great noble, bowing in token of his respect for woman. Were she incarnate in a woman whom it was impossible for his mother or his sister to know. And at every moment, recognized in the depths of the liquid transparency and of the luminous glaze of the shadow which her parasol cast over her. Madame Swann was receiving the salutations of the last belated horsemen, who passed as though in a cinematograph taken as they galloped in the blinding glare of the avenue. Men from the clubs, the names of whom which meant only celebrities to the public, Antoine de Castellane, Adalbert de Montmorency and the rest, were for Madame Swann the familiar names of friends. And as the average span of life, the relative longevity of our memories of poetical sensations is much greater than that of our memories of what the heart has suffered, long after the sorrows that I once felt on Gilberte's account have faded and vanished, there has survived them the pleasure that I still derive whenever I close my eyes and read, as it were upon the face of a sundial, the minutes that are recorded between 12:15 and 1 o'clock in the month of May, from seeing myself once again strolling and talking thus with Madame Swann, beneath her parasol, as though in the coloured shade of a wisteria bower. Place names. The place. I had arrived at a state almost of complete indifference to Gilberte when, 2 years later, I went with my grandmother to Baalbek. When I succumbed to the attraction of a strange face, when it was with the help of some other girl that I hoped to discover Gothic cathedrals, the palaces and gardens of Italy, I said to myself sadly that this love of ours, in so far as it is love for one particular creature, is not perhaps a very real thing, since, if the association of pleasant or unpleasant trains of thought can attach it for a time to a woman so as to make us believe that it has been inspired by her, in a necessary sequence of effect to cause, yet when we detach ourselves, deliberately or unconsciously, from those associations, this love, as though it were indeed a spontaneous thing and sprang from ourselves alone, will revive in order to bestow itself on another woman. At the time, however, of my departure for Baalbek, and during the earlier part of my stay there, my indifference was still only intermittent. Often, our life being so careless of chronology, interpolating so many anachronisms in the sequence of our days, I lived still among those far older days than yesterday or last week in which I loved Gilberte. And at once not seeing her became as exquisite a torture to me as it had been then. The self that had loved her, which another self had almost entirely supplanted, rose again in me, stimulated far more often by a trivial than by an important event. For instance, if I may anticipate for a moment my arrival in Normandy, I heard someone who passed me on the seafront at Baalbek refer to the secretary to the Ministry of Posts and his family. Now, seeing that as yet I knew nothing of the influence which that family was to exercise over my life, this remark ought to have passed unheeded. Instead, it gave me at once an acute twinge, which a self that had for the most part long since been outgrown in me felt at being parted from Gilberte. Because I had never given another thought to a conversation which Gilberte had had with her father in my hearing, in which allusion was made to the secretary to the Ministry of Posts and to his family. Now, our love memories present no exception to the general rules of memory, which in turn are governed by the still more general rules of habit. And as habit weakens every impression, what a person recalls to us most vividly is precisely what we had forgotten, because it was of no importance, and had therefore left in full possession of its strength. That is why the better part of our memory exists outside ourselves, in a blatter of rain, in the smell of an unaired room, or of the first crackling of brushwood fire in a cold grate. Wherever, in short, we happen upon what our mind, having no use for it, had rejected, the last treasure that the past has in store, the richest, that which when all our flow of tears seems to have dried at the source, can make us weep again. Outside ourselves, did I say? Rather within ourselves, but hidden from our eyes in an oblivion more or less prolonged. It is thanks to this oblivion alone that we can, from time to time, recover the creature that we were. Range ourselves face to face with past events as that creature had to face them, suffer afresh because we are no longer ourselves but he, and because he loved what leaves us now indifferent. In the broad daylight of our ordinary memory, the images of the past turn gradually pale and fade out of sight. Nothing remains of them. We shall never find them again. Or rather, we should never find them again had not a few words, such as this secretary to the Ministry of Posts, been carefully locked away in oblivion, just as an author deposits in the National Library a copy of a book which might otherwise become unobtainable. But this suffering and this recrudescence of my love for Gilberte lasted no longer than such things last in a dream. And this time, on the contrary, because at Baalbek the old habit was no longer there to keep them alive. And if these two effects of habit appear to be incompatible, that is because habit is bound by a diversity of laws. In Paris, I had grown more and more indifferent to Gilberte, thanks to habit. The change of habit, that is to say, the temporary cessation of habit, completed habit's task when I started for Baalbek. It weakens, but it stabilizes. It leads to disintegration, but it makes the scattered elements last indefinitely. Day after day, for years past, I had begun by modeling my state of mind more or less effectively upon that of the day before. At Baalbek, a strange bed, to the side of which a tray was brought in the morning that differed from my Paris breakfast tray, could not obviously sustain the fancies upon which my love for Gilberte had fed. There are cases, though not, I admit, commonly, in which, one's days being paralyzed by a sedentary life, the best way to save time is to change one's place of residence. My journey to Baalbek was like the first outing of a convalescent who needed only that to convince him that he was cured. The journey was one that would now be made probably in a motor car, which would be supposed to render it more interesting. We shall see, too, that, accomplished in such a way, it would even be in a sense more genuine, since one would be following more nearly in a closer intimacy the various contours by which the surface of the earth is wrinkled. But after all, the special attraction of the journey lies not in our being able to alight at places on the way and to stop altogether as soon as we grow tired, but in its making the difference between departure and arrival not as imperceptible but as intense as possible, so that we are conscious of it in its totality, intact, as it existed in our mind when imagination bore us from the place in which we were living right to the heart of a place we longed to see, in a single sweep which seemed miraculous to us, not so much because it covered a certain distance, as because it united two distinct individualities of the world, took us from one name to another name. And this difference is accentuated more than in a form of locomotion in which, since one can stop and alight where one chooses, there can scarcely be said to be any point of arrival, by the mysterious operation that is performed in those peculiar places, railway stations, which do not constitute, so to speak, a part of the surrounding town, but contain the essence of its personality, just as upon their signboards they bear its painted name. But in this respect, as in every other, our age is infected with a mania for showing things only in the environment that properly belongs to them, thereby suppressing the essential thing, the act of the mind, which isolated them from that environment. A picture is nowadays presented in the midst of furniture, ornaments, hangings of the same period, a second-hand scheme of decoration in the composition of which in the houses of today excels that same hostess who but yesterday was so crassly ignorant, but now spends her time poring over records and in libraries. And among these, the masterpiece at which we glance up from the table while we dine does not give us that exhilarating delight which we can expect from it only in a public gallery, which symbolizes far better by its bareness, by the absence of all irritating detail, those innermost spaces into which the artist withdrew to create it. Unhappily, those marvellous places which are railway stations, from which one sets out for a remote destination, are tragic places also. For if in them the miracle is accomplished, whereby scenes which hitherto have had no existence save in our minds are to become the scenes among which we shall be living, for that very reason we must, as we emerge from the waiting room, abandon any thought of finding ourselves once again within the familiar walls which, but a moment ago, were still enclosing us. We must lay aside all hope of going home to sleep in our own bed, once we have made up our mind to penetrate into the pestiferous cavern through which we may have access to the mystery, into one of those vast, glass-roofed sheds like that of Saint-Lazare, into which I must go to find the train for Baalbek, and which extended over the rent bowels of the city one of those bleak and boundless skies, heavy with an accumulation of dramatic menaces, like certain skies painted with an almost Parisian modernity by Mantegna or Veronese, beneath which could be accomplished only some solemn and tremendous act, such as a departure by train or the elevation of the cross. So long as I had been content to look out from the warmth of my own bed in Paris at the Persian church of Baalbek, shrouded in driving sleet, no sort of objection to this journey had been offered by my body. Its objections began only when it had gathered that it would have itself to take part in the journey, and that on the evening of my arrival I should be shown into my room, which to my body would be unknown. Its revolt was all the more deep-rooted in that on the very eve of my departure I learned that my mother would not be coming with us. My father, who would be kept busy at the ministry until it was time for him to start for Spain with Monsieur de Norpois, having preferred to take a house in the neighbourhood of Paris. On the other hand, the spectacle of Baalbek seemed to me none the less desirable because I must purchase it at the price of a discomfort, which, on the contrary, I felt to indicate and to guarantee the reality of the impression which I was going there to seek. An impression the place of which no spectacle of professedly equal value, no panorama which I might have gone to see without being thereby precluded from returning home to sleep in my own bed, could possibly have filled. It was not for the first time that I felt that those who love and those who find pleasure are not always the same. I believed myself to be longing fully as much for Baalbek as the doctor who was treating me when he said to me, surprised on the morning of our departure, to see me look so unhappy, "I don't mind telling you that if I could only manage a week to go down and get a blow by the sea, I shouldn't wait to be asked twice. You'll be having races, regattas, you don't know what all." But I had already learnt the lesson, long before I was taken to hear Burma, that whatever it might be that I loved, it would never be attained save at the end of a long and heart-rending pursuit, in the course of which I should have first to sacrifice my own pleasure to that paramount good instead of seeking it there. My grandmother, naturally enough, looked upon our exodus from a somewhat different point of view, and, for she was still as anxious as ever, that the presents which were made me should take some artistic form, had planned so that she might be offering me of this journey a print that was at least in parts old, that we should repeat, partly by rail and partly by road, the itinerary that Madame de Sévigné followed when she went from Paris to Lorient by way of Chaulnes and the Pont Audemer. But my grandmother had been obliged to abandon this project at the instance of my father, who knew, whenever she organized any expedition with a view to extracting from it the utmost intellectual benefit that it was capable of yielding, what a tale there would be to tell of missed trains, lost luggage, sore throats, and broken rules. She was free at least to rejoice in the thought that never, when the time came for us to sally forth to the beach, should we be exposed to the risk of being kept indoors by the sudden appearance of what her beloved Sévigné calls a beast of a coachload, since we should not know a soul at Baalbek, Le Grandin having refrained from offering us a letter of introduction to his sister. This abstention had not been so well appreciated by my aunts Céline and Flora, who, having known as a child that lady, of whom they had always spoken until then to commemorate this early intimacy as Renée de Combremer, and having had from her, and still possessing, a number of those little presents which continue to ornament a room or a conversation, but to which the feeling between the parties no longer corresponds, imagined that they were avenging the insult offered to us by never uttering again, when they called upon Madame Le Grandin, the name of her daughter, confining themselves to a mutual congratulation once they were safely out of the house. I made no reference to you-know-whom. I think that went home. And so we were simply to leave Paris by that 1:22 train, which I had too often beguiled myself by looking out in the railway timetable, where its itinerary never failed to give me the emotion, almost the illusion, of starting by it, not to feel that I already knew it. As the delineation of our minds of the features of any form of happiness depends more on the nature of the longings that it inspires in us than on the accuracy of the information which we have about it, I felt that I knew this train in all its details. Nor did I doubt that I should feel, sitting in one of its compartments, a special delight as the day began to cool, should be contemplating this or that view as the train approached one or another station. So much so that this train, which always brought to my mind's eye the images of the same towns, which I bathed in the sunlight of those post-meridian hours through which it sped, seemed to me to be different from every other train, and I had ended, as we are apt to do with a person whom we have never seen, but of whom we like to believe that we have won his friendship, by giving a distinct and unalterable cast of countenance to the traveller, artistic, golden-haired, who would thus have taken me with him upon his journey, and to whom I should bid farewell beneath the cathedral of Saint-Lô before he hastened to overtake the setting sun. As my grandmother could not bring herself to do anything so stupid as to go straight to Balbec, she was to break the journey halfway, staying the night with one of her friends, from whose house I was to proceed the same evening, so as not to be in the way there, and also in order that I might arrive by daylight and see Balbec Church, which we had learned was at some distance from Balbec Plage, so that I might not have a chance to visit it later on when I had begun my course of baths. And perhaps it was less painful for me to feel that the desirable goal of my journey stood between me and that cruel first night on which I should have to enter a new habitation and consent to dwell there. But I had had first to leave the old. My mother had arranged to move in that afternoon at Saint-Cloud, and had made or pretended to make all the arrangements for going there directly after she had seen us off at the station, without needing to call again at our own house, to which she was afraid that I might otherwise feel impelled at the last moment, instead of going to Balbec, to return with her. In fact, on the pretext of having so much to see to in the house which she had just taken, and of being pressed for time, but in reality so as to spare me the cruel ordeal of a long-drawn parting, she had decided not to wait with us until that moment of the signal to start, at which, concealed hitherto among ineffective comings and goings, and preparations that lead to nothing definite, separation is made suddenly manifest, impossible to endure when it is no longer possibly to be avoided, concentrated in its entirety in one enormous instant of impotent and supreme lucidity. For the first time I began to feel that it was possible that my mother might live without me, otherwise than for me, a separate life. She was going to stay with my father, whose existence it may have seemed to her that my feeble health, my nervous excitability, complicated somewhat and saddened. This separation made me all the more wretched, because I told myself that it probably marked for my mother an end of the successive disappointments which I had caused her, of which she had never said a word to me, but which had made her realize the difficulty of our taking our holidays together, and perhaps also the first trial of a form of existence to which she was beginning now to resign herself for the future, as the years crept on for my father and herself, an existence in which I should see less of her, in which, a thing that not even in my nightmares had yet been revealed to me, she would already have become something of a stranger, a lady who might be seen going home by herself to a house in which I should not be, asking the porter whether there was not a letter for her from me. I could scarcely answer the man in the station who offered to take my bag. My mother, to comfort me, tried the methods which seemed to her most efficacious. Thinking it to be useless to appear not to notice my unhappiness, she gently teased me about it.
"Well, and what would Baalbek Church say if it knew that people pulled long faces like that when they were going to see it? Surely this is not the enraptured tourist Ruskin speaks of? Besides, I shall know if you rise to the occasion. Even when we're miles apart, I shall still be with my little man. You shall have a letter tomorrow from Mama."
"My dear," said my grandmother, "I picture you like Madame de Sévigné, your eyes glued to the map, and never losing sight of us for an instant."
Then Mama sought to distract my mind, asked me what I thought of having for dinner, drew my attention to Françoise, complimented her on a hat and cloak which she did not recognize, in spite of their having horrified her long ago when she first saw them, new upon my great-aunt, one with an immense bird towering over it, the other decorated with a hideous pattern and jet beads. But the cloak having grown too shabby to wear, Françoise had had it turned, exposing an inside of plain cloth, and quite a good colour. As for the bird, it had long since come to grief and been thrown away. And just as it is disturbing sometimes to find the effects which the most conscious artists attain only by an effort, occurring in a folk song, on the wall of some peasant's cottage, where above the door at the precisely right spot in the composition blooms a white or yellow rose, so the velvet band, the loop of ribbon which would have delighted one in a portrait by Chardin or Whistler, Françoise had set with a simple but unerring taste upon the hat, which was now charming. To take a parallel from an earlier age, the modesty and integrity which often gave an air of nobility to the face of our old servant, having spread also to the garments which, as a woman reserved but not humbled, who knew how to hold her own and to keep her place, she had put on for the journey, so as to be fit to be seen in our company, without at the same time seeming or wishing to make herself conspicuous, Françoise, in the cherry-coloured cloth now faded of her cloak, and the discreet nap of her fur collar, brought to mind one of those miniatures of Anne of Brittany painted in books of hours by an old master, in which everything is so exactly in the right place, the sense of the whole is so evenly distributed throughout the parts, that the rich and obsolete singularity of the costume expresses the same pious gravity as the eyes, lips, and hands. Of thought, in relation to Françoise, one could hardly speak. She knew nothing, in that absolute sense in which to know nothing means to understand nothing, save the rare truths to which the heart is capable of directly attaining. The vast world of ideas existed not for her. But when one studied the clearness of her gaze, the lines of nose and lips, all those signs lacking from so many people of culture, in whom they would else have signified a supreme distinction, the noble detachment of a chosen spirit, one was disquieted, as one is by the frank, intelligent eyes of a dog, to which, nevertheless, one knows that all our human concepts must be alien, and was led to ask oneself whether there might not be, among those other humble brethren, our peasant countrymen, creatures who were, like the great ones of the earth, of simple mind, or rather, doomed by a harsh fate to live among the simple-minded, deprived of heavenly light, were yet more naturally, more instinctively akin to the chosen spirits than most educated people, were, so to speak, all members, though scattered, straying, robbed of their heritage of reason, of the celestial family, kinsfolk that have been lost in infancy of the loftiest minds, to whom, as is apparent from the unmistakable light in their eyes, although they can concentrate that light on nothing, there has been lacking, to endow them with talent, knowledge only. My mother, seeing that I had difficulty in keeping back my tears, said to me, Regulus was in the habit when things looked grave. Besides, it isn't nice for Mama. What does Madame de Sévigné say? Your grandmother will tell you. I shall be obliged to draw upon all the courage that you lack. And remembering that affection for another distracts one's selfish griefs, she endeavoured to beguile me by telling me that she expected the removal to Saint-Cloud to go without a hitch, that she liked the cab, which she had kept waiting, that the driver seemed civil and the seats comfortable. I made an effort to smile at these trifles and bowed my head with an air of acquiescence and satisfaction. But they helped me only to depict to myself with more accuracy Mama's imminent departure, and it was with an agonized heart that I gazed at her as though she were already torn from me, beneath that wide-brimmed straw hat which she had bought to wear in the country, in a flimsy dress which she had put on in view of the long drive through the sweltering midday heat. Hat and dress making her someone else, someone who belonged already to the Villa Montretout, in which I should not see her. To prevent the choking fits which the journey might otherwise give me, the doctor had advised me to take, as we started, a good stiff dose of beer or brandy, so as to begin the journey in a state of what he called euphoria, in which the nervous system is for a time less vulnerable. I had not yet made up my mind whether I should do this, but I wished at least that my grandmother should admit that, if I did so decide, I should have wisdom and authority on my side. I spoke, therefore, as if my hesitation were concerned only with where I should go for my drink, to the bar on the platform or to the restaurant car on the train. But immediately, at the air of reproach which my grandmother's face assumed, an air of not wishing even to entertain such an idea for a moment, "What?" I said to myself, suddenly determining upon this action of going out to drink, the performance of which became necessary as a proof of my independence, since the verbal announcement of it had not succeeded in passing unchallenged. "What? You know how ill I am. You know what the doctor ordered, and you treat me like this." When I had explained to my grandmother how unwell I felt, her distress, her kindness, were so apparent as she replied, "Run along, then, quickly. Get yourself some beer or a liqueur, if it will do you any good," that I flung myself upon her, almost smothering her in kisses. And if, after that, I went and drank a great deal too much in the restaurant car of the train, that was because I felt that otherwise I should have a more violent attack than usual, which was just what would vex her most. When at the first stop I clambered back into our compartment, I told my grandmother how pleased I was to be going to Balbec, that I felt that everything would go off splendidly, that after all I should soon grow used to being without Mama, that the train was most comfortable, the steward and attendants in the bar so friendly that I should like to make the journey often, so as to have the opportunities of seeing them again. My grandmother, however, did not appear to feel the same joy as myself at all these good tidings. She answered, without looking me in the face, "Why don't you try to get a little sleep?" and turned her gaze to the window, the blind of which, though we had drawn it, did not completely cover the glass, so that the sun could and did slip in over the polished oak of the door and the cloth of the seat. Like an advertisement of a life shared with nature, far more persuasive than those posted higher upon the walls of the compartment by the railway company, representing places in the country the names of which I could not make out from where I sat. The same warm and slumberous light which lies along a forest glade. But when my grandmother thought that my eyes were shut, I could see her now and again from among the large black spots on her veil, steal a glance at me, then withdraw it, and steal back again, like a person trying to make himself, so as to get into the habit, perform some exercise that hurts him. Thereupon I spoke to her, but that seemed not to please her either. and yet to myself the sound of my voice was pleasant, as were the most imperceptible, the most internal movements of my body. And so I endeavoured to prolong it. I allowed each of my inflections to hang lazily upon its word. I felt each glance from my eyes arrive just at the spot to which it was directed, and stay there beyond the normal period. Now, sit still and rest, said my grandmother.